When I wrote the abstract for this talk, of course, I didn't really know what I would be able to actually talk about. So I promised to explain to you for whom and to do what the science of sound was developed in the 17th century. And that turns out to be a really simple question, which can be answered right here in like 3 minutes. Basically, it was developed for princes and other ruling people in order to be able to speak to everybody, to be heard by everybody, to hear what everybody says, and not to be heard themselves when they don't want to be heard. So basically, if it was about that, you could just all leave. It was problem solved. Other things in the abstract are kind of more complicated, and I hope to actually know about them by now, but I found out that I won't be able to answer those questions. Basically, those about how 17th century ideas about privacy influence or maybe stuck around to become our ideas about privacy, and how these things, what stuck or what didn't stuck. That turns out to be really complicated, and if you hope to actually learn the answer to that, you could probably leave now as well, because I won't be able to give it to you. So what I'm actually going to do is to rather describe and show you how this 17th century science of sound and surveillance looked like and felt like, and what the driving ideas behind it were. That starts not in the 17th century, but slightly before, what the ideas of sound actually... What? What? That wasn't me.
Okay, that's different.
There I am again. Okay, this is probably the slide that's going to be on the longest, so it shouldn't reappear as a problem. Whatever.
You just have to stop the display going to sleep.
Yeah, but it's not my machine, so I'm kind of like, what the hell? Okay. Now that was too much wiggling. So the 17th century starts where the 16th century stops, and in the 16th century there were basically two ideas of what sound is. One is one that is kind of common to us as an explanation. Basically, you throw a stone into water and then there's ripples on the surface, and sound is like that only in air. That sounds really modern, and that sounds like they actually had an idea of what a sound wave is, but it's not. This is just a very simple picture they used. They had no idea about, I mean, this is basically a two-dimensional wave thing, and they had no idea what it's like to have a sound wave that's actually more like a sphere going out in all directions in space, and no concept of pressure and pressure changes and what that means. So it seems like a wave theory of sound, but really it's not. And the second one, which was a bit more developed at the time, was that whatever sounds or emits sound actually emits little tiny copies of itself called species, and that these species travel through space and reach the nerves and the imagination, and from there comes the idea of the tone we hear. That's an idea that was actually taken from optics, where also, like, what you see is basically tiny, tiny version of the object you're seeing that has reached your eye. That theory doesn't make sense on a lot of levels, basically because it doesn't explain perspective or why things look bigger when they're closer. And it's also, in sound, is kind of a makeshift option. It's like what you use to describe it if you don't really know how to go about it. And apart from these two ideas, a very important influence of 17th century acoustics and science in general was the notion of natural magic. We have it from this guy, or not just this guy, but he wrote a book that It's titled Magia Naturalis. And no, that was one too much. Ach. Nee. Here. And the notion of natural magic basically says that nature is made up from lots of hidden occult forces, and these forces, they are not really supernatural, they are natural, hence natural magic, but they are hidden and mysterious, and it's if you find out about them, you can do wonderful things with them. So it's an idea about power as well. And certain devices that astonish or surprise are also part of this whole notion of natural magic, because when you produce something wonderful, a wonderful effect, by making use of these hidden forces in nature that other people don't know about, then you produce a magical device, which can entertain or whatever. But so magic is a very different thing than what it would be for us today now. And it's also a thing that's very close to experimental science, because it's both about finding out about these hidden forces in nature and about making use of them and applying them to produce devices that do something surprising, which means you have to understand how they work exactly. One of these devices, which was often used for, let's say, shows of natural magic, was a pair of vibrating strings. Because you have this phenomenon where one string, when it is tuned exactly to the same tone as the other, will also sound and vibrate if you pick one and it sounds, and then the other will sound. And this is wonderful because, wonderful or magical, because there's no apparent influence, nothing obvious happening between the one string and the other string. You just sound one and the other will sound as well. And it's kind of hard to make out why if you're a 17th century person. So this is really important point to stress, that these vibrating strings, this is a magic that actually works. If you think in the mindset of the time, you can actually prove that magic works. Of course, this this whole vibrating string thing got adapted by scientists later on, who were very much thinking that they were above magic and were better than magic. And the first of them was probably, or the first in my talk to appear at least, is Francis Bacon, who drew up this grand program of what experimental science is supposed to be or could be and what it could do. And he also happened to paint a grand picture of what the science of sound, which didn't really have a set name by yet, could actually make. And he described superior people in one of his books that had perfected this science of sound and which could produce wonderful tones and sweet tones and magical echoes which would come back at you louder than you actually spoke, and which could change the sounds you make and break them, and also devices to improve hearing. And lots of great things, but he never actually did much of it. So he said, well, somebody, you know, should do this sometime and then stuff will be wonderful, but he wasn't the one to actually do it. Now, the science that he described, he said it would be a superior natural magic. He knew Della Porta, and he overtook many of the things that Della Porta wrote, like whole passages and experiments and stuff that crop up in Bacon are actually taken from Della Porta's Magia Naturalis. But he was very fond of making a distinction between him and Della Porta and saying that, well, I'm going to do this right. This Bacon, he was still, just a little bit of background, I mean, he was a person at court, and in a way, you could say maybe a court magician. So one of his roles was to keep the king, the English king, entertained by coming up with strange things and experiments to look at. One of them probably the vibrating string. Yeah. Now, the first person to actually put into practice what Bacon wanted to have done was Mr. Mersenne, Marin. I don't know how his first name is actually pronounced, but what? Marin, probably, could be. Yeah, Marin, okay. And at the time, he was like the one person scholarly journal, because if you wanted to have some fact or some discovery known at the time, you would just write a letter to Mr. Mersenne, and he would write letters to everybody he knew, and he knew lots and lots and lots of people, and that's how a new fact would become known. He would also do lots of experiments himself. And he was a mathematician as well, and one of the experiments he did was to span a strong rope, a really thick, strong rope, and long one too. Don't ask me about the numbers. And make it vibrate, and with a sound that he could actually still identify. And the sound was so deep that he could actually, or he thought he could, count the vibrations by his, like, just with his eyes. So he was the first person to have a pretty good grasp of the idea of absolute frequency, so that it's not just the length of the strings you can measure or the widths, but that, that you really know, okay, this tone is vibrating so and so often per minute or second or whatever it is you want. He would also measure the speed of sound. He was one of the first. I mean, Bacon proposed a way, you know, you could measure the speed of sound if you did this and that, but Mersenne actually did it in a very strange way, because, I mean, we're in a time before there are really precise clocks, so it's not just like pressing on a timer and saying, now is it over or something, but he did it with echo. He went to a place where there was a strong echo, and he knew where it was coming from. And he found a word, I think it was Benedictum. And he said that word, and he just said Benedictum, Benedictum, Benedictum. And he would note the syllable by which the first version of it came back to him. And then he would try to find the distance between where he himself repeatedly saying Benedictum, Benedictum, Benedictum would be exactly attuned to the echo coming back. And from that he could say, okay, Benedictum, if I say it, it takes me so long to say it, I'm so far away from the wall. And he got an approximate value for speed of sound, which changed quite a bit from experiment to experiment. But so that was the first idea too. Actually put into practice measuring the speed of sound. Now, Mersenne was very much anti-magic, and he was very much trying to use the new notion of experimental science as a way to fight heretics, because he thought that science could give such security and proof that there would be no place for heretical thoughts anymore, which was the reason why he liked it so much. And the joke in this is that Mr. Mersenne himself would probably be described as pretty magical and esoteric by anyone looking at him today. His main book about music and sound was called Harmonie Universelle, and it really meant that he still believed in a very harmonically ordered universe, where everything was measured in harmonical ratios. The only difference really was that he said the old natural magicians, they thought they could, they knew the harmonies in the universe before they even looked, and therefore they are wrong. But I'm just, you know, I know there are harmonies in the universe because I looked first, and that's why I'm right. Now, one of these harmonies still has to do with a vibrating string, because he first had an idea that consonance isn't actually caused by harmonical numerical ratios. So it's not that, you know, the octave is 1 to 2 in the length of the string or what you take, and that it's because it's 1 to 2 that it sounds nice to our ears. But he developed this theory that there are sound particles or air particles all vibrating in this frequency, and that when they coincide on the ear in this relationship, or in small relationships, that is what sounds nice to our ears. This isn't, in practice, it doesn't make much of a difference which theory you adopt. It's just that he's still about the string, and it's still harmonical, and the universe is still full of wonderful things and mysterious things to find out. Now, the last person, or no, the second to last person I'm going to talk about, this guy, Athanasius Kircher, he in turn, I mean, we've seen by now, Bacon took over stuff from De La Porta, Mahamar Sen took stuff from Bacon, and Kircher copied just large parts from Mersenne, really a lot from Mersenne. He basically wrote whole chapters and sections of his books just translating Mersenne from French into Latin. One of these books was the Musuria Universalis, which was more or less a version of Mersenne's Harmonie Universelle, with lots more stuff thrown in that Kircher thought was interesting. And the second one was the Phonologia Nova, a little bit later, 1673, we're by now. And this is probably the first book to actually exclusively deal with acoustics. This one was a bit earlier, 1650. So in this time, acoustics kind of became a discipline of its own. Before, it was thrown in with music mostly, what a tone was and what sound was, it wasn't, yeah. And now Kircher is a very, very strange person. Kircher was a Jesuit, he was working in Rome, and he was a friend of Mersenne's, one of these people who got lots of letters from Mersenne about new stuff, but Kircher also became lots of letters from all the Jesuits that were traveling the world and trying to find out what is actually going on these other continents that are still fairly new, and in China and wherever. So he gets a lot of incoming information, and he thinks he's able to, or he tries to bring it all into a form to make beautiful books from that would be entertaining to his patrons and would make sense of this mess of new information coming in. Because Kircher was very much dependent on patronage. He was not a nobleman himself. He was he needed always someone with lots of money and power to be able to just print his books, because they would pay the printer. And he was also the guy responsible for the first museum in Rome. So the museum, it wasn't a public institution like it would be now, but the Museum of the Jesuits, it was kind of a place to go to where strange things were collected, and there could be devices, that could be stones, that could be plants from other continents. And Kircher would sometimes receive visitors and show them around and explain to them what was what. And these visitors were often noble people, usually noble people. I mean, you needed to be somebody to get into there, because not public. So he actually had used for many acoustical, wonderful playthings. Some of them, and it doesn't always become clear which ones he actually built and which ones he only dreamt up. Well, some of them were about using echo. Now, maybe you will pick up why this idea, how to build walls so you can get multiple echoes, would not have worked. The thing is, if you actually want to get something like that, that the distance you have to have between the first and the second wall, so you notice actually that it's two echoes and not just one, is so big that it would have been hard at the time to actually produce a sound that is loud enough in the beginning to travel, you know, there and then back again, and actually keeping it apart. So this is a nice idea in theory, but apparently not one of the ones he built himself, because no, couldn't have worked. This is one of the few instances where he actually found out something that nobody had known before and that he got right. This explains how in a building where you have one space where you can talk and another space rather far away where it sounds like the person talking is just standing right beside your side, functions. Basically, you have an elliptical form and these lines of reflection are pretty accurate. He also noticed that for sound reflecting purposes, you don't have to be as precise as for light reflecting purposes, but he didn't really make a, I mean, of course he didn't really know what like wavelength, what it actually means and why it is that way, so he just noted it. But this is an idea for a speaking trumpet or speaking tube, where you get a visualization of the sound ray. This actually worked, and still works. I mean, it's just a megaphone, basically. But the thing about Kircher is, in 1673, he was claiming that he was the guy who invented it, which is not true. But you could see the whole Fonogia Nova as a big, big book just to strengthen this claim of his that he was a guy who invented this whole sound art devices thing. This is how he explained the horn of Alexander the Great. Because apparently there's a story about Alexander the Great that he had a big horn through which he could communicate with his whole troops. And now Kircher set about to think about, okay, if he had this, I mean, Alexander, big troops, so big horn, and what would have worked the best? Now, Kircher believed that sound was strengthened with each reflection. So the more reflection you get, the stronger the sound comes out of the horn, which is why he, in the end, says that it couldn't have been a straight cone like a megaphone, but instead it would have been something like this circular, bended thing because there's more reflection in there. This, of course, is completely not true and very, very strange. Yeah, very, very wrong. And he does claim that he has experimented with this and knows that it has to be right. So it's kind of, yeah. This is another story that he tries to explain of a tyrant in classical Greece who had his palace up there and his captives down like in the basement, or rather in these grottos down there. And there were channels up, and the claim was that the tyrant was able to hear what his captives were talking. And there is a grotto and place in Greece where they think this might have been, or that it is the source of the story. And, well, the thing is that the grotto produces lots of reverb, so whatever you say, whatever you do, it makes a big noise. But in the place up on the mountain, you cannot you cannot understand a word because it just all gets warped and you cannot make out any sense of the noises coming from downtown, from down there. It's just, yeah. But Kircher believed in it, and he thought he could have, you know, he himself could have made it work, which is, of course, a kind of promise and way to tell the people who are giving him his money to print his books, hey, I can do really great things for your palace, and maybe you want to listen in on your captives. I'm going to tell you how. Yeah, this is one of the most absurd diagrams that I've found in the whole book. I wasn't completely able to make out what it is about, because the Anacephaleosis Magia Naturalis is actually a chapter about how to make a talking statue. So it could be that in the upper room where A is, there is imagined to be a statue which is talking, or which is making the sounds that are coming from outside. It could also be that in this room A is somebody who's trying to listen in and who is in the room E. I honestly don't know.
If you get a really big horn and shove it out the window.
Just the mic, please.
It could just hit. Hello? Hello? It is on. Hello? No, it's off. Dead. It could just be that there's a really big horn and you have to put your really big horn out the window and you hear it.
Oops. Yeah, but then why is the ray going down back to the other window, which is closed anyway, but...
Sheer genius.
Well, most of these pictures actually exist in two versions, because the stuff from the Fonogia Nova in 73 is much recycled material from the Mosogia from 1650. But so this is from 1650, and in the respective part from 1673, he's left it out, so maybe he wasn't so sure what it was about either anymore anyway. So, yeah, now it becomes a bit more concrete with the whole who's actually doing the talking here, because this is one of the ideas for people to talk in private, in secrecy, and every time he describes a device like this, which is, of course, again, meant to be elliptic. He just talks about princes who might want to converse in private. That's the idea. They look very strange. There's a second version. I mean, this guy, he's, you know, his eyes are like... And again, he thinks that this kind of bended thing would be much more effective than the simple elliptic thing, which would actually work at least a little bit as we know today. But yeah, so that's the idea. This is again the later version. It's not really obvious from the text if he thinks that at the side of this table there are other people who are not supposed to know what the two people at the head ends are talking. It could be. It also, I mean, the sentence says that the second version, which is more like the inner ear, that it was built at the, like in nature, that nature was an example of it, and that for that reason it has a wonderful force of collecting sound. So apparently he was so sure that this bended thing works better because it looks like the inner ear, or more like the inner ear. And yeah. Now this is the big version, between houses. And again, we're not talking about houses, but the text is very clear that this is to be built between palaces. Now we are in Rome. So Rome, you have lots of bishops and noblemen from all over Italy who try to be important by being in, you know, the papal city, and many, many really rich people doing many conspiracies and intrigues and stuff. So there are actually many palaces in the city. It's not a one palace. It's not just that you have this one important person and this one big palace, but yeah, many rich people, many important people, many palaces, and apparently they want to talk to each other, or he thinks they want to talk to each other. This is the extended version, again, to make the claim that the bent thing down there would work best. I have no idea how he thought that anything like this could actually be built in a distance where it would be useful. But he was very sure that these things work. And he also, I mean, there's one description of an experiment he did, which I think can be believed. And that was to take one of these conical tubes and put it on top of the church steeple, and by that device call all the people in the parish to come to church, come to Mass. So, but that wasn't built, and it was a much smaller scale than anything he proposes here, and, well. Yeah, well, it's not just, we're coming back to the point where natural magic and science in this time are actually also part of entertainment. So here he's not only telling his prince that, you know, you can do this useful secret communication thing with me and I'm going to tell you how to talk to your troops, but he's also suggesting that by building something like this, you could have a band of musicians play in one room and, well, just transmit the music somewhere else, wherever you want to have it. The second version of this picture is this, where it's much more specific where the music is to be transmitted to. So in the upper right corner, there's again the prince, who now doesn't have to put up with the presence of lowly musicians anymore in order to enjoy his music. Yeah, they kind of have the role of the captives in this grotto a bit. But, I mean, it's the same idea. This is a bit confusing, but the second version tells it better. This one. Now, this is probably the picture where I thought, well, maybe there's a topic about surveillance and stuff in here, because the idea is clearly the prince sits in the middle room and he just hears everything that is said in his palace. And this reminded me very much of the idea I had read in Foucault about the Panopticon of Bentham, which is about 100 years later, the idea, not the praxis. The idea in the Panopticon is that you have, this is, well, how it looks if somebody would build it in the 20th century, you have this tower in the middle where somebody is sitting, or not, you don't ever really know, and he can watch everything the inmates in these cells do, because here we are talking about inmates. It's an idea for a prison, basically. Now, the parallel, of course, is that you have one guy who cannot be heard or cannot be seen, who's listening or seeing everything all the other people say or do. But it turns out that these ideas are completely different. They are so, so very different that it's hard to speak of surveillance in this version at all. It's not really. So, what are the differences? One of the differences, apart from the whole here we have listening, there we have seeing thing, is that in the first instance, we have surveillance just of the people who are in the prince's palace. It doesn't necessarily mean that they have to be there. It doesn't say if they're inmates or if they're just passing through. And in the Panopticon, we have inmates who really have to be there. And they cannot talk to each other. In the palace, the whole point of the device is to listen in on what the people are talking to each other. That means the people are in contact. They can move around freely. In the Panopticon, they can't. They're just one person per cell, and there's no conversation. There's no. So the prince, the listening in that he does is kind of more personal. It's this whole idea of intrigue in this important city where he always has to be afraid of somebody making a conspiracy against him, maybe even his own trusted people. And this is a point that is of no interest whatsoever in the Panopticon. The Panopticon is less about people, of course it's not at all about people plotting to do wrong, and more about people doing things properly, so that they're not lazy, that they're not misbehaving, that they're doing what they should do, where in the Panacousticon, how it could be called, in the palace, it's just about listening in if they do something they should not do. It's not really, it doesn't care about if they do things right or not. It's just, if there's danger coming, then the prince wants to know. So the prince is more a paranoia thing, where the Panopticon is, of course, what it's known for, a discipline thing. The prince's palace device can obviously also use for entertainment, and not just if there's musicians playing, but also maybe the prince is just bored and wants to know what's going on. But, you know, a prince cannot just go down there and talk to common people. So maybe he's just lonely and bored and wants to know what's going on. While in the Panopticon, the form of it derived from certain forms of entertainment in the 18th century, where you have a big picture and you go there and it's a picture that just goes around 360 degrees and you think you're kind of entrapped in this world. But the Panopticon in this form isn't designed really for anybody to have pleasure in it or to be, you know, used as a pleasure device. At least it's not admitted, but it's a very strange form of pleasure if you have pleasure from it. What? For example, but...
Repeat the question, please. No, perverse. There's some sort of perverse. It makes perfect sense. It's off.
But you can't watch the people do anything interesting. It's not like you're, you know, watching them doing anything private. You're just watching them being alone by themselves, not being allowed to do anything.
And that's also if you're a pervert as well.
Yeah, okay. Other kind of pervert. But, yeah, and there are also very different ideas about government and ruling embodied in these two pictures, because in the first one, you have clearly the guy on top who has the perfect right, and there's nobody complaining or anything about that. This guy on top, this one person, is allowed to listen to everybody, or at least everybody in his palace. But and the other is kind of more democratic, because the idea in this whole Panopticon thing is, or one of the ideas connected to it, that there's not just one guy sitting in the tower in the middle watching everybody else, but that all the people that are not actually inmates in the cells are allowed to come in and do the watching for the watchers. So the idea is that there would be no tyranny possible, because all that is watched is if the rules are actually followed. The rules, of course, are not questioned, and everybody can make sure for themselves, can drop by and can do the watching and can make sure that the rules are being followed. Yeah, most don't really seem to have any notion of the idea of privacy that could be violated here. It just doesn't really appear. So I thought there was a long history of that this whole idea of a Panopticon was actually much, much older than most people who are interested in it assume today. And I found out, no, it in the 16th century or in the 17th, it would probably not have made sense to anybody to have a building like the Panopticon, because the whole idea of government and rule and what powerful people like to do and like to know and want to, you know, want to be capable of was very different from just 100 years later and from today. Yeah. So that's it.
So we have, we've got loads of time for questions. So if folks have questions, do we have any more mics available? Yeah. So if you could put your hand up if you've got a question, and I don't know your name. Sorry.
Helmut.
Sorry?
Helmut.
And Helmut here will give you the mic, and you can ask Una, who will no doubt provide a brilliant answer. One here.
One question is, those things you told about the acousticon, mm-hmm. are these things that at that time were considered seriously, or was it more like a fantasy, like, you know, the Wired magazine about the flying car at that time?
Well, the line between serious and entertainment wasn't as straight as it is today. So Kircher was a very highly regarded person. He was very... His books were actually read by, I mean, he got the Imperator, whatever, the Emperor. He got the Emperor to be his patron, and he wouldn't have gotten that level of patronage if people were thinking, oh, you know, this Kircher guy, he's so down there, we won't be bothered. And the whole... That the point that something was wonderful or mysterious was actually something that made it scientific in Kircher's mind, because that meant there's something to be found out. And there were other people, I mean, the Royal Society later, they took up Mersenne and Kircher's works, and they tried to repeat all the experiments he described. So he was read, people were interested, and tried to follow up on it.
Okay. Other questions? Oh, gentleman here, and then that fellow there.
At that time, the idea of truth was already installed in scientific community, I think, or it's starting to at least. So why do you think he just stated things that were obviously not true, although his whole work is part of a community where you had to experiment and prove what you're saying already?
Well, I think by the time he started out, and he was planning most of his books really early in the 17th century. So by the time, like by 1640, he actually already had a plan for what he wanted to publish for the rest of his life, and a lot of the material as well. And for him, the line between something he experimented himself and something somebody he trusted told him wasn't that important. And also for him, because some of the fantastical stories came from very highly regarded sources, and he was trained in this whole scholastic tradition that had a lot of weight for him. So it wasn't necessarily obviously wrong to him. And also, I mean, there's a thing about the vacuum, where apparently he really made the experiment himself with quicksilver in a glass tube and put it on his head and had a little bell in the glass tube and struck the bell, and he still heard it. And he concluded from that the vacuum doesn't exist and isn't possible, among lots of other things that he concluded. And the experiment, how he performed it, it's entirely reasonable if you still hear the bell and you think the bell needs air to be heard, that, well, vacuum doesn't exist. What he didn't know was that the sound transmission was probably not through air in the glass tube, but through the hinge on which the bell was hanging. So he said, I made this experiment, vacuum doesn't exist, he's wrong, but he's entirely reasonably wrong. But there is a thing about him that he doesn't seem to care about consistency much. So sometimes he comes upon a phenomenon that doesn't fit the old explanation he's given a couple of pages before. And what he does is he cites the old explanation, but he doesn't say, well, I said that a couple of pages before. But what he says is, some people believe that. But as we can see, this explanation doesn't work. So now I am giving you the right explanation. So it's contradictory, but he doesn't care.
Nice. And we'll take a question from the outside world.
Yeah, asking a question from the IRC network. And the question was, were there any pre-plans to make a full duplex connection? So like back and forth?
Well, I mean, the technology like this is back and forth in a way. I mean, the elliptic thing is duplex. Okay. It's just by the way how it, yeah.
Okay, this fellow over here. And
so listening to your talk, one thing that struck me was actually, even though his technology was wrong, there are very striking parallels between the applications that he was trying to present and basically what we've evolved to today, like the how many governments and how many people have bugged offices, how we all listen to our iPods or whatever so that we don't have to have musicians handy to listen to music, all of these things. Are there, was he inventing the applications, or is there something that predated his applications, or was he inventing those and it just took considerable amount of time for the technology to catch up?
Well, much of this he really didn't invent. He claims he invents it, but for the speaking tubes, I mean, the more megaphone-like ones, they are probably at least a century older, just not written about, and just not written about by people accepted as scholars. And then Bacon already says that something like this exists, but he doesn't describe it in detail. I don't think he actually invented anything that worked the way he described it. The whole thing with the elliptical sound reflection is that he didn't invent it. He knew there were buildings that functioned like that, and he was just the first guy to explain why it works that way. But yeah, a friend of mine said that, oh, probably Kircher just wanted to have a radio and...
Actually, I have a question. Is there any evidence that he ever went to Turkey? Because Hagia Sophia has that elliptical form and is you know, very, very, very old and is acoustically, you know, extraordinarily effective. No, no evidence, nothing like that. Okay. It's just that that's very old indeed. Do we have any other questions? Stunned silence. Wow, you've managed to bludgeon the crowd into silence. So I guess, do we have any other questions from the IRC network? No? Okay.
Well, if anybody actually wants to look at Kircher's book himself, it's completely in very high resolution on the internet at the Echo Project. It's probably better you just jot down the Echo Project and Kircher than, you know, try to type the link, but, and yeah, other books.
Okay. Great. So, big hand, please, for Una. And if anyone wants to put their musicians in a dungeon later, we'll be arranging that for you shortly.